You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Welcome back to Genesis 1, one of the most obsessed over chapters of the entire Bible. Let me remind you that Genesis 1 is just the first of two creation stories, the second of which is Genesis 2. And most scholars agree that Genesis 1 was written long after the Genesis 2 account, the one with Adam and Eve. So you have Adam and Eve kind of floating around for a long time before the authors of Genesis 1 come along, probably during or shortly after the Babylonian exile, to judge creation. How do we know this? Well, the language is different, the style is different, the order of events are different. Plus, Genesis 1 is dripping with politics and theological propaganda, mostly aimed at dissing the Babylonians and their god, Marduk. Another element of Genesis 1, inconvenient to fundamentalists, is the portrayal of human beings being created. Unlike Genesis 2, where Adam is created first and Eve second, you'll notice that in our passage today, not only are male and female created at the same time, but both are created godlike, reflecting God's nature equally. So, for our purposes today, the important thing to listen for is the way this tale contradicts the fevered efforts of fundamentalists the world over of putting women in second place, incapable of making decisions for themselves, and deserving of being everything from outright owned to being denied equal treatment under the law by the wiser, stronger, and far superior sex.
Our words of wisdom are from Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, adapted from the Message version. God spoke,
"Let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature so they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, the earth itself, every animal that moves on the face of the earth."
God created human beings, created them godlike, reflecting God's nature. God created them male and female. God blessed them.
"Prosper, reproduce, fill the earth, take charge."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, a young couple was in a car crash. Sadly, the husband died, and the woman was in a coma. But the good news was, the twins she was pregnant with were fine. Later, still in a coma, she gave birth to a healthy boy and girl. When she finally came out of the coma, the doctor gave her the sad news about her husband, but the good news about her twins. He also told her that her brother had named them and was caring for them. "Oh, no," she replied. "My brother is an idiot. What did he name them?" "Well," said the doctor, "he named the girl Denise." "Well, that's not so bad," said the woman. "What did he name the boy?" "Denephew." Ah, if only naming our children was our biggest concern. But for most people, there's a lot of ground to cover before having a child, let alone naming one, or deciding to not have a child, or trying and not being able to conceive, or being surprised by a pregnancy, or giving a child up for adoption, or being pregnant because of assault, or discovering that your long-planned-for child is sick in utero and won't survive beyond birth. The entire topic of women's rights, childbirth, and reproductive rights is at one and the same time one of the most complex parts of life and one of the least talked about outside of pressure-filled and emotional moments demanding immediate decisions. And believe me, in preparing this message, I have asked myself repeatedly, what was I thinking? Who am I? Just another white middle-aged man telling women what to do? But then I thought, well, that's exactly why I should include this in a series on Getting On Message. Progressively minded Christians, men and women together, have thought a lot about the topic of women, justice, and reproductive rights. And we need to let people know that they're not alone in making what, in many cases, are the toughest decisions they will make in their whole lives. As most of you know, last summer, the Supreme Court overturned the reproductive protections established in 1973 with Roe versus Wade. And as a result, states across the country have passed more and more punitive laws that restrict or outright ban access to reproductive health care. What you may not know is that the United Methodist Church is a longtime partner with other faith groups in working to protect women's access to abortion and family planning. Why? Because the United Methodist Church has also been an advocate of the shockingly radical idea of recognizing women's full humanity. And along with acknowledging that controversial fact, we've had to deal with the reality that when answering the question, is a woman capable of moral discernment? A shockingly large number of Christians worldwide say, no. So, when facing the decision of whether or not to have an abortion, for whatever reason, women's opinions are dismissed or worse, leveraged against them to deepen what is often already a personal, familial, societal, and spiritual crisis. What to do? As I've advocated for years, United Methodists have a gift to offer the world that is often ignored. And yet it's one of the most effective tools we have of getting on message, and that's our Wesleyan quadrilateral. The four elements that we use to make practical, thoughtful, and faithful decisions in the real world. So, let's consider what scripture, tradition, experience, and reason have to say about women, justice, and reproductive rights. First off, scripture. The word abortion is not mentioned in the Bible anywhere, but there are plenty of examples of terminating pregnancies, mostly in passages so graphic you might question the appropriateness of even reading them in church. God orders the Israelites to crush the heads of enemy babies and rip open their pregnant women. In Deuteronomy, God even goes so far as to threaten the Israelites with the punishment of being forced to, quote, eat the fruit of their own wombs. Yikes. Then in one passage, Exodus 21, it describes people who are fighting, then injuring a pregnant woman and inducing a miscarriage. What's the penalty? A monetary fine. However, it's pointed out that if the baby is fully formed and capable of life outside the mother, then the penalty is death. So, if the baby is not fully formed, the penalty is financial, just like any other property crime, giving no support to the argument that gives equal religious and moral value to the mother and the fetus. One verse you'll hear many anti-abortion activists clinging to is Jeremiah 1:5, claiming that it clearly condemns abortion. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you, and I ordained you a prophet to the nations. But Jewish interpretation will point out, and it is their book, how this is about the inevitable call and destiny of one person, Jeremiah, to be a prophet. It's not about when fetal life or personhood begins. The bottom line, there is no biblical law forbidding the practice of abortion. What the Bible does give us is a portrayal of human beings, both men and women, who are complex, many-sided creatures with, according to today's passage, the godlike ability and responsibility to make choices, to take charge. Then there's tradition. You don't have to be a church historian to know that the church and Western civilization in general has a checkered past in recognizing the full humanity of women in the first place. I mean, what do you expect when people like Aristotle say, the deliberative part of a woman's soul is impotent and in need of supervision? Based on Ephesians, St. Augustine believed that women had no head of their own and had to depend on their husband for thinking. Martin Luther found women to be deficient and needed to accept the subordinate role in relationship to men. And as recently as a century ago, it was common to speak of the danger of educating women regarding their own reproductive functioning. Now, over time, this lopsided understanding of humanity has changed for the better, but echoes still reverberate in church and public life. Then there's personal experience. One evening in 1912, Margaret Sanger, nurse, Episcopalian, and founder of Planned Parenthood, received urgent word to come to a tenement on Grant Street in New York City. When she arrived, she found a young Russian mother of three dying from a self-induced abortion. For 3 weeks prior, she and a doctor had battled the infection. The woman pleaded for information that would help her prevent another pregnancy. The unsympathetic doctor said, "So, you want your cake and eat it too? That's impossible." The doctor said, "Go and tell Jake to sleep on the roof." The woman waited until the doctor left before begging Sanger for the secret. Sanger promised to return, but procrastinated, knowing that there really was no information she could provide that would give the woman what she wanted. When Sanger did return 3 months later, it was in response to the woman's frantic husband. The mother died within 10 minutes of Sanger's arrival. Sanger went to bed that night knowing that no matter what it might cost, I was resolved to do something to change the destiny of mothers whose miseries were as vast as the sky. As a pastor, I can relate to Sanger. My experience covers the gamut from counseling families who drove their young teen daughter to another state for an abortion, to accompanying women parishioners to a clinic for various procedures, to refereeing between family members over how to make these huge decisions. And all along the way, the church has been used to defend antiquated ideas that have one common thread: denying women their autonomy and basic humanity. Sadly, the clash of values in our culture seems to thrive on cruelty. Women who are faced with reproductive decisions are picketed, legislated into impossible situations, preached at, and vilified by total strangers who have no idea about their target's life situation. Their decisions, often made in secret, are lamented, scorned, ridiculed, and now criminalized. Right now, women experiencing an accidental miscarriage or stillbirth in some parts of our country already tragic events, can and are being charged with murder. What they seldom experience, though, is permission, with full moral agency, to wrestle with what are already difficult decisions, compounded by unique challenges, colored by extenuating circumstances, and do so encouraged by, supported by, and loved by their spiritual community. That tradition needs to change. And then there's reason. Our Constitution promises everyone the freedom to believe what they want. And that includes personal decisions about reproductive health. I understand that for many religious folks, abortion is a moral absolute akin to murder. But that's why separation of church and state is so important. It ensures that we continue to pursue a society where religious disagreements can coexist. For instance, many evangelical and fundamentalist Christians believe that a fetus is fully human at conception. And that's definitely one way to look at it. However, in the Jewish tradition, based on biblical precedent, a baby is not considered a person until its head emerges from the mother's body, essentially when it's separate from the mother. So, who has the authority to make the final decision? The pregnant woman is in the middle of multiple allegiances to herself, family, church, and cultural norms. Any rational consideration would also need to include profoundly relational considerations, like, what about an additional child aggravating the effects of overwhelming poverty, of dooming children to disease, deadly sweatshop conditions, and early death? Or if the pregnancy is the result of sexual violence, including incest? What about the pregnancy compromising the mother's health? Who do you choose, mother or fetus? What about just plain ignorance, insulating a young woman from fully understanding her procreative powers? Then, of course, there's the dark side of abortion for the sake of gender selection. It's estimated that under China's one-child policy, hundreds of millions of female fetuses were aborted or were victims of infanticide. Meanwhile, some just try to stick to the simple argument that
there are just too many dad-blamed abortions, and the only solution is a total ban.
When what they really mean is that women are just too casual about sex and should suffer the consequences of motherhood for their lustfulness. We should deny them the opportunity to casually commit murder to get out of an embarrassing fix. But the truth of the matter is that until a few years ago, the rate of abortions in the United States has been going down for 30 years, in large part due to better access to birth control, which some conservatives would like to eliminate. So, if scripture, tradition, experience, and reason tell us anything, it's that these reproductive decisions are downright complicated. But nevertheless, according to our Genesis passage, individual human beings, even women, have the agency and authority to make their own decisions, guided by their own conscience, personal circumstances, and in the best case scenario, their faith communities. But hang on, what gives me, a white, middle-class, middle-aged man, the right to talk about any of this? The same might be asked of my career-long advocacy on behalf of the LGBTQ+ community. I'm a straight, cisgender man, but I know injustice when I see it. And in the final analysis, this whole conflict isn't even about women. It's about men and the power they perceive They'd be losing if they yield to the idea that women are of equal worth and capabilities as men. Plus, if it weren't for the systematic advance of women's reproductive rights, I wouldn't even be here. I asked my mom permission to share this with you, but she was among the very first women to ever start taking the pill. And because of that scientific advance, one that conservative Christians continue to claim is against God's will to this day, my mom's cycle was able to be regulated. I was born because of the availability of birth control. Likewise, conservative Christians continue to argue against the morality of in vitro fertilization, a technique that they claim wastes viable human beings in the process of aiding those who would otherwise be unable to have children. I, however, am forever grateful for the availability of this scientific miracle, because without it, there'd be no Maddie or Sam Felton. I'll always remember the day about 5 years ago when Sam and Maddie had a chance to meet our fertility doctor, Drew Moffitt, for lunch. Sam ran up to him, gave him a huge hug, and exclaimed, "So, you're the mad scientist who created me! Thank you for that!" Yes, indeed. And here's the thank you note that Maddie wrote to Dr. Drew. "I'm thankful that my life and the lives of my children have literally been made possible by awe-inspiring scientific advances that nevertheless to this day continue to be vilified by those who claim to know the mind of and speak on behalf of God. For far too long, the church has betrayed the example and teachings of Jesus and given unwarranted preference to male humanity over female humanity. We have colluded with cultural traditions in denying the full personhood of women, who are not only made in the image of God, but gifted with the biological and miraculous capacity to bear children. It's time for us to boldly get on message, retract past wrongs, and support women's full agency and capacity for moral discernment, up to and including the ability to make decisions about their reproductive lives, unfettered by antiquated laws and punitive religious sensibilities. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.